Hello, and welcome to episode 52 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grundislav, and with me as always...
Hello, I am Ben Chandler, also known as Ben304. How are you, Francisco?
I'm doing quite well. How are you doing?
I don't care. I just ask to be polite.
Oh, okay.
Please don't answer.
Okay. Do you know that if you listen to one podcast a week, you would now have sufficient podcasts for one full year of entertainment? Something to think about.
That is something to I'm thinking about it right now. Good. Therefore, you have proved your point. It really is something to think about.
Good, good. So how are you, Chandler? What have you been up to
this week? I finished Techno Babylon.
Congratulations.
Yesterday.
Good.
Thank you. It feels good, you know?
Like, yeah.
It's been a good project to work on. We pretty much, there are a few hold-ups here and there, as games always will have, but, you know, it's done. It's good. I feel good about it. I learned a lot. If I could do it all again, I'd do it differently, but,
we can all say that.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, it feels good.
Good.
And I've started work on the next project, which is a project with you.
Is it?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Surprise.
Oh, my God.
Surprise.
I better get to work.
Yes, you had. End of podcast. Chop, chop. Yeah, so, and, I haven't played much games lately. I saw Breakfast at Tiffany's at the movie theater, which had a funny cat in it.
Yes.
I showed you the cat, and you agreed with me that it was funny. How could you not? I played through a very old 1991, I believe, DOS game called Dark Designs 1, which was made by John Carmack. And I enjoyed that a lot. It's like an old dungeon crawler. So I played through that last weekend, and yeah, that's good.
Why are they called dungeon crawlers? You don't do much crawling, really, in them. I mean, you don't get down on your belly and...
Yeah, you don't really crawl much in a pub crawl unless it's really serious.
True,
so, you know.
That's true, yeah.
It's just, you're not running through them. You're gradually progressing. Which I guess, you know, when traffic slows to a crawl...
Yeah.
You're not actually, wah-wah, crawl.
Yeah, sure, exactly. You're not, you don't become a baby. Although some people might become babies in traffic. I know I certainly used to. Well, I actually became more of a raving madman in traffic than a baby, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, well, everyone's got their way. I dated a girl that used to just go off in traffic. Like, I'd laugh at her because it was just not even... Like, you'd be driving down the road, going somewhere, and there'd be two lanes, and someone would just drive slightly faster than her and go past, and she'd, like, start going off at them, and I'm just, why? What have they done? So if you wanted to be the winner, then you should have gone faster.
Yeah.
It's very simple. Anyway, so how are you?
I'm well. I've finished with a Golden Wake. I know I've said that several
times. You've said that every podcast for the last 10 months.
No, but now for real, I really am. Like, the code has frozen. It's uploaded.
This time's serious, guys.
No, really. The code is frozen. It's been updated. Dave Gilbert himself played it yesterday and said, this is done.
And then as soon as he said that, made you change something.
Well, yeah, but, you know, that's how it works. So yeah, it's finished. I've washed my hands of it. It has a release date, which I'm not allowed to say. But if I tweeted yesterday, you know, clear your calendars for October. We have a release date, and I have also begun working on not only the next project that I'm working on with you, but I've also begun practicing drawing backgrounds and things for the next project I have in mind after that, which I know very little about myself.
Sure.
But I'm trying to...
Well, you're in the planning stage, I guess.
Sure, and there's also the
it's
fact
time
that...
to learn.
Yeah, there's also the fact that I haven't really drawn a background in a while because I finished my backgrounds for A Golden Wake a while ago, and I'm not going to be working on backgrounds for our game, so I don't want to get out of practice. So I want to, you know, develop my skills and do as much as I can in the interim, you know?
Yeah, as I was telling you before, it'd been a long time. Like, doing the backgrounds that I'm going to be doing for this project is very different to what I had to do for Techno Babylon. So
yeah.
It was actually a little cumbersome for me today to sort of pick up a thing and get into Photoshop and just start painting. That's weird for me now, so it took a while, but you know, progress has started.
Sure, good.
I mean, obviously we already have like 7 or 8 scenes done for the game from before, but you know.
Yeah, true. But
you know.
Yeah, on the games front, I actually have played a couple of games. I played and I finished The Last Express last weekend, which was quite enjoyable. Although I found it a bit
hard. You seemed to feel it was a little hyped up.
Yeah, I mean, I respected what they did, and I liked the fact that it was real time and everything, but I was under the impression that there was going to be a lot more going on than there actually was, and as a result, when I first started, I was just kind of like, I feel like I'm missing out on everything, you know? But, yeah. So it was a little hard to get into, but once I got into it, it was enjoyable. And overall, I enjoyed it, so if you haven't played it, I recommend it. Play The Last Express. Plus, there's rotoscoping in it. Because it's a Jordan Mechner game, and Jordan Mechner, a man after my own heart, he likes rotoscoping.
He's rotoscoping, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, play it. It's good. I also, after a delightfully challenging install process and patch downloading and everything,
yeah.
I finally started playing Planescape Torment.
Hooray!
Hooray! But I only got as far as the first screen because I couldn't figure out how to use a key on a door. So
I think you need to right-click and bring up the verb coin.
I did.
Or the GUI coin.
I did, and I loaded the key in my hand, and I tried it anyway, and it didn't work. So I need to read the manual. Maybe I'll do that a little bit more this weekend. Yeah, I know. So I'll probably play a little bit more of that this weekend.
Good.
But yeah, I've what I played of it so far, I enjoyed. I enjoyed the opening movie, and I enjoyed assigning things to my character, and I also enjoyed the start new life, resume life, and the abyss options on the
that's fun.
On the menu.
We were talking about it, how it kind of starts with this, you wake up and you've lost all your memory, and it feels like such a cliche, but when you really go about it, name sort of 10 other games that have done that.
Yeah, it's this sort of really...
It feels like such a cliche, yeah. But I think it's more in like stories and films than it is in games.
It is, actually. Yeah. Actually, yeah. It's funny because I remember during the voice recording process, we had an actor named Andy Manjuk who... He's very much a gamer, I suppose, because he, you know, we were talking about games and stuff, and he, as he was leaving, he was like, oh, I had this idea for a game where it's kind of like, you know, making fun of philosophy and stuff, and like, you know, you wake up and you don't remember who you are, you have amnesia, you know, that old cliche, and I was like, oh yeah, and he's like, so the first thing you say is like, who am I? And all the philosophers outside are like, ugh. So, kind of putting a spin on that amnesia versus philosophical questions.
I see.
It was amusing. I see. Anyway.
Yeah.
It was
I'm
kinda
not
like,
laughing, but I'm a soulless husk of a human being.
It was
so
kind of like walk out
on that.
Yeah, it was walk out the door joke. You know how those are.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway.
Good. Well, I'm glad you've started playing it. I feel like it's probably the number one most influential game that I've ever played for me personally. So. As anybody that's listened to one of these podcasts at least could tell.
Yeah.
So hopefully you enjoy it. If not, well, that's understandable. It can be hard to get into, you know?
Yeah, well, I've managed to get into The Last Express, so I can get into anything. I'm a guy who likes to finish what he starts, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And Torment is definitely worth finishing.
Yeah. So,
good.
There's that. I also played a fun game. This is not a computer game, but it is very much an adventure game called Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective. It's a sort of pen and paper, not board game. But, yeah, I was telling you about it before we recorded. It's actually very cool. Yeah, it's cool. You can play it alone, or you can play it in teams, or you can play it...
Well, obviously, if I was going to play it, I'd play it alone. Like, wah.
Really?
Yeah, well, I don't have any friends. Sit home and fucking cry.
That's not true. You could play it with Monty.
You could
put like a little hat on him and say he's Watson or something.
That's basically my entire life summed up in one sentence.
Dr. Katzen.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's a fun game, and it was enhanced by the fact that you have to read everything out loud. So I was doing the silly voices out loud, and those. I played it. Yeah, it was very fun to play by candlelight, listening to like, you know, music and stuff. It was very interesting.
Good.
I can't talk anymore.
I understood you.
Yeah.
Mostly because I can't talk either.
So I'm glad you understood me, because I don't think the listeners will understand, but that's fine.
That's fine. They don't matter. Well, they don't. No, they don't care.
You're absolutely right.
If they're listening to this podcast after last podcast, their standards aren't very high.
That's absolutely true. And boy, are they in for a treat, because guess what? We don't have a topic this week.
We do have a topic.
Oh, yeah, we do have a topic. I forgot already.
What was the topic? We're not ready for topic yet.
Oh, okay. Well, then please continue.
We don't actually have a topic, but we're still going to talk about relevant things.
Well, yeah, but we were going to talk about learning things, weren't we? Things we've learned. It's sort of like a retrospective clip show podcast, except we don't have clips because I'm not going to edit them in.
It's a filler episode, basically. Not really. I think it's an essential thing. Learning as you go is an essential thing to be both aware of and also proactive in.
Okay, good. So every time you finish a project, you come out of a project and you think, I've learned something new.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
What would you say, now that you've finished Technobabylon, what have you come out of Technobabylon having learned?
I've learned that my sense of perspective was actually really bad, and that I needed to work on that a lot.
Couldn't be any worse than mine.
But it's still bad. I learned that my human proportions are pretty bad, so I need to work on that.
Mm. Well, I've been nagging you about that for a while now.
I know. But I think there's like a point where you have to be ready to do it, you know? Like, there's a point where you have to go, all right, now's the time. You know, I'm comfortable with all the stuff I can do. I'm finally ready to take on board new knowledge, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah.
So I think, like, I had to get to that point where I'm like, all right, I'm now comfortable enough with this other stuff that I can sit down. And I bought a book by Andrew Loomis, who's an excellent illustrator, and I've been studying that quite a bit. I've been drawing faces, I've been drawing skeletons, I've been drawing bodies. And, it's going to be an interesting thing, you know. Drawing faces is hard for me, drawing bodies is hard for me. So there's a limitation of doing pixel art for so long, I think.
Hmm.
That's two of the things I've learned. And so now, like, for the next project, I'm using perspective guidelines, which I always swore off, and I always told everyone not to use. I was wrong.
Hmm.
You should use them. I'm doing a lot of construction drawing. All the things that I told everyone not to do, I'm now doing. I'm a massive hypocrite. I was entirely wrong, and I accept that.
Well, you know, admitting your mistakes is the first step to recovery.
Yeah, I think it's more powerful a tool and insight when you start doing that stuff after doing it wrong for so long and you finally see how much it can help you than doing it from scratch and just going, okay, well, this is part of the process without knowing why you do it, without understanding what strengths it gives you and what you can build upon using them.
Hmm.
Yeah?
Oh, so hang on a minute. I don't mean to derail your thoughts here. But something just occurred to me that we didn't cover in our preamble.
Okay.
And that is that you did, in fact, play and finish a game since our last podcast. You finished King's Quest VII.
I did finish King's Quest VII. That's correct.
I can see that it's entirely forgettable because you didn't mention
it.
Well, I'm curious.
King's Quest VII.
Tell me what you
thought. King's Quest VII started out very badly. We didn't get along very, very well from the start. There's a lot of... I mean, I started straight after King's Quest VI, and so King's Quest VII was a massive change in tone and a massive change in focus and philosophy, you know. So there was that. And then after a while, I kind of got used to it, and I kind of got into it. And then in the last two chapters, it just went downhill so badly.
Mm.
And that's saying a lot, because the middle of King's Quest VII is not great. But look, I understand why they made some of the choices. They're experimenting, they're trying to do new stuff, but King's Quest VI is a superior game.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for saying that on the record.
Mm. No, it is. It is. King's Quest VII, I gotta say, having played... There are only, in my understanding, three King's Quest point-and-click adventures.
Yes. Five, six, and seven.
Having played them all... it's weird to go from 5 and 6, which are fairly thematically consistent, to seven, which blows it all out the water and you know, focuses on the kind of the less mature side of the story. You know, there's it doesn't feel so much like you're exploring this world. It feels like you're more limited, and the puzzles are much more basic. And yeah, I miss the exploration side of it a lot.
Yeah, it's more like you're in Disneyland than you're in like an actual land.
It kind of does, actually, now that you mention it, it does kind of feel like a theme park. You're like, oh, now we're in the troll bit. Oh, now we're in the desert bit. Now we're in the undead bit. Now we're in the fairy bit. It does really feel like that. Now that you've said that.
I mean,
whereas in King's Quest V, it feels natural to go from like woodlands and grasslands to a desert.
Sure.
To then to an icy place. In King's Quest VI, it's different islands, which still feels a little bit Disney when you get to like the kiddie stuff, but it's less jarring.
Yeah. So, there's certainly a lot less crying in King's Quest 5 and 6.
Yeah, there's a lot of crying in King's Quest 7. It's like the characters have been thinned out even more from the archetypes which King's Quest 6 and 5 kind of sits on to just this really paper-thin cast of not very interesting characters. Like, the most interesting and memorable character is the fact that there's a bull that runs a china shop. That's it.
And it's also,
all I can remember. And the headless horseman's wife is pretty.
It's also interesting that, like, King's Quest V, the voice actors were all Sierra employees, so the voice acting was terrible. And then King's Quest VI, they actually got Hollywood talent, so the voice acting was good. And then King's Quest VII, they had real actors, but it was sort of middle-of-the-road kind of...
There's kind of... Some of it, I think they so tried, great. Because of the cartooniness of it, I think they were hamming it up a little more.
Yeah.
You know, and so it kind of gets Cedric'd. Where it gets really annoying for just, like, pointless reasons, you know? They're trying to be endearing or funny or quirky, but it just comes off as too much.
Yeah. Oh,
so, that's my impression. I mean, having played the 3 point-and-click King's Quest games, 6 is clearly the best, you know?
Good.
I can see why everybody says that, so...
Good.
I've still got 1, 2, 3, 4, and 8 to play, so we'll see.
Yeah, good luck with those. Right, so anyway, moving back to our sort of topic of learning things.
Learning.
Yeah, so you talked about Techno Babylon and learning perspective and proportions. Anything else? Anything besides art? I mean, I know you were pretty much limited to art, but in playing the game, did you learn anything about, you know, pacing or story or anything like that?
Yeah, well, always, you know, I'm always taking notes. I'm always looking at what works, what doesn't, you know. It's interesting because Techno Babylon's a little bit more linear than Blackwell and other stuff I've worked on. So it's kind of interesting to see how that plays out. Kind of more like a film where you're progressing through different areas, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to see what works there, what doesn't feel like it works quite so well. And, you know, and just like art-wise, just more trying to... Like, with Blackwell, I was trying to just do sort of real-world-looking locations. In this, I was trying to keep it... Like, I was trying to do more, like, futuristic scenes and stuff like that, but while also still trying to keep it grounded. Because, like, a lot of techno-punk... Like, techno-punk, cyberpunk sort of stuff, they just go overboard and there's neon everywhere, and none of it means anything, you know? And it was really interesting for me to try and make every light and every gadget still have some meaning in the game.
Mm.
That's really important for me, you know. If you're going to have something in your world, have a reason for putting it there.
Sure.
So, yeah. I love world building, you know. And even if I'm just using art to build a world, I really love thinking about it. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing that? And, I learned a lot.
Well, from what I've seen on our project so far, even just what you've shown me today, you're certainly taking that into consideration.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, going into the first scene the first scene after finishing Techno Babylon that I started today, I was like, I really wanted to approach it with this sort of concept of a world in mind and really flesh out this huge, like, this living, breathing place. That's always my goal.
Yeah, of course.
You know, to give a sense that there's something beyond the screen, beyond the borders.
Yeah,
so,
you don't want your... I think our King's Quest analogy was a good one in that you don't want your game to feel like a theme park. You want it to feel like an actual world.
Yeah, like a lot of games, like, if you're playing, for example, like Mario or Zelda or stuff like that, you'll go Fire World, Forest World, Snow World, stuff like that. That's cool in that, but we're trying to build a world that feels thematically whole. You know? So we want everything to feel a little more consistent.
The only place I can think of where you can go from, like, you know, Jungle World to Fire World to Desert World. Well, Fire World is Desert World. But the other place, like, Jungle to Desert to City to like, ice flow and everything is Australia. So unless you're setting your game in the entirety of Australia, you're not going to have that much of... Or you're traveling around the world. You're not going to have much...
Well, you could do it in America. America's pretty varied. The United States.
Yeah, but we pretty much just have, like, desert and... we don't have jungles in...
You've got tundra.
Yeah, but that's like in Canada, up north.
You've got the giant redwood forests.
Yeah, but we've got forests, we've got deserts, and that's about it. Well, there's swamps down the southern part.
Yeah.
But there's no jungle.
Yeah,
like rainforest.
Australia is pretty diverse.
Yeah.
So we're pretty cool.
Yes, and you've got kangaroos.
We do. We absolutely do. Oh, so, yeah.
Never mind. Okay, I'm not going to say that on the podcast.
I know what you were going to say.
You knew what I was going to say. It is rude.
It's impolite. Yeah, so for me, like, being a very inexperienced artist, you know, and being very stubborn...
two excellent qualities in an artist.
Yeah, yay. How did I get a job? You know, it's been working for Dave... has been a very educational experience for me. I know when I first started working for him and I started working on Black Wheel Deception, he was like, "Oh, you're going to learn a lot, you know." And I was like, "Oh, okay." Cuz I thought, you know, I was like, I wouldn't have applied for the job if I didn't think I could do it, you know. So I was like, "I think I can do this, you know." And he's like, "Yeah, you're going to learn a lot doing this." I'm like, "Okay, well, we'll see, you know." And you know, 3 years later, 4 years later, yes, I have learned a lot. I mean, I was learning a lot anyway. You always should. You always should push yourself.
Yeah.
I've found this year, you know, as you know, like, I tried acrylic painting. I've started pencil drawing. And one thing I really found with pencil drawing is it really helped me to look at stuff, you know, because when I'm painting with a brush in Photoshop, I use quite a big brush and it blobs out, so I block out a lot of stuff without looking at what I'm drawing a lot, you know. And I often paint with my eyes quite blurred, so I do a lot of rough work, a lot of blobbing out, a lot of just sort of not really focusing on what I'm drawing but more the general sort of idea of what I'm drawing. Whereas using a pencil, in order to get it to look right or better, you really have to focus on each contour, each little line, you know. So that's really... And painting's sort of the same. It taught me to look at different things. I think observation is as important in drawing as the actual technique and method that you draw by. The ability to observe something, you know. I was at my grandma's for dinner before I returned home to do this podcast and do some drawing. And I've been talking to her about drawing and, you know, stuff like that and explaining certain ideas to her. And I showed her an example. She had, like, a green bottle, like a green glass bottle sitting over there. And I said, "Oh, what color's the bottle, you know?" And she said, "It's green." And I said, "Look at it closely. If you look really, really close from the angle we're sitting at, there's actually very little green there because it's in a dark part of the room. Most of the bottle is actually black. And there's spots of white where the light's shining off it, and there's just a tiny little bit of green here and there. Like, for example, what color is a tree? What color is a tree trunk?"
Well, it's many colors, but I, you know, in our perceived notion, they're usually brown. But
right, so
they're not brown.
I said, "What color is a tree trunk?" And she said, "You know, brown." So I found she had like a picture of trees on the wall. And she said brown, and I picked up the picture and I took it over to her and I said, "Look, these trees are white. They're white and they're grey with little bits of orange in there." And she actually, we sort of sat there and we looked around the room and we looked at different things and said, "Look, that leaf is mostly white because of how the light's hitting it, you know, and the light's shining off it," and stuff like that. So it's really interesting, the more you draw, the more you learn to observe stuff. And learning to paint with actual paint and learning to draw with a pencil has really helped me in my powers of observation. And I'm really trying to focus on that now, trying to get myself so I'm looking at things better.
Sure, you know? I mean, it's pretty much just, you know, when you're a kid and you're in school and you get your box of crayons and it's like, oh, draw a tree. And you kind of, you know, you do the brown trunk and the green blob on top that looks like leaves and stuff like that. And it's kind of like the idea you have in your head your whole life about what color things are generally. But it's not until you sit down and look at them that you realize that there's so much more to them.
Absolutely.
And like, it's an important thing to get out of, a habit to get out of, because if you just sit there and you draw all your tree trunks green or brown and you do all your leaves green, then it's going to look like a kid drawing or a coloring book or something.
It looks like kind of naive and also looks amateurish. Yeah. And I've been drawing faces a lot, I'm really trying to practice so I can get good at faces.
Yeah.
And you get stuck in this idea of icons, of symbols, where you go, I know what an eye looks like. So you draw what you think an eye looks like. You don't really know what an eye looks like until you have studied an eye from all the different angles, from all the different expressions. Like, I have realized in the last week that I literally have no idea what an eye looks like. I have got so much learning to do so I can figure out what an eye looks like. I learned things about eyes this week that I was like, how did I not see this before? I've been drawing them wrong my entire life.
Yeah, well, yeah, those things, and I fall into those traps too. You told me the other day that, you know, and it's true that all my noses tend to look the same, because I got to a point where I was like, oh, I know how to draw noses, and I just follow the same basics to draw them all the time.
You follow a pattern, yeah.
I follow the pattern, and that does make them end up looking very samey. And when I broke away from that and, you know, just drew noses as observed, it changed completely, so...
It really brings, like, it really, that's how you step up to the next level, you know?
Yeah.
You say, I'm not, instead of going, I know how this looks, you have to say, I don't know how this looks, I'm going to learn how this particular nose looks. And every nose will be different, every eye will be different, you know? There are rules that hold for most circumstances, but it's the same with color, you know? Depending on how the lighting's set up, you know, what kind of day it is, you know, and what you know, the surrounding environment, things reflect, things bounce light off them, things shine. It's entirely like, you know, for example, my grandma had a laptop sitting on a pink jumper and like on a sort of a brown couch. And I said to her, look at the laptop from where we're sitting. I said, it's not black. It's black in one tiny little spot, but then the side of it is all a really dark pink where it's reflecting the jumper that it's sitting on. Mm-hmm. The top of it is the kind of dark, like smoky brown color where it's reflecting the thing. You have to take that stuff into account. You really got to stop going, I know what color this is. I know what shape this is. You have to. I'm sure people learn this straight away at art school. I'm sure this is... Are people like anyone that's been to like painting or drawing courses is probably going, yes, Ben, we know. You know, but when... Because I've found this stuff out for myself, or, you know, had people tell me a million times and I was too stubborn to listen, it really seems like a huge revelation now to me and an essential part of educating yourself in drawing.
Yes, good.
Good.
Well, that's good. Did you learn anything else?
Yeah, I've learned a lot of stuff, you know?
Okay.
Like, we were talking about... I was thinking the other day, like, after playing King's Quest V, I was thinking about some of the stuff. And we had a bit in the game that we're working on where there was an action that the first time you performed it, you failed the action. And the solution was to perform the same action again. And it was going to be justified by the story, by the person not being very good at that skill yet, and everything like that. But the more I thought about it, there's a part in King's Quest V where you have to walk into a desert. And when you walk in the desert, the owl says to you, don't walk in the desert, you'll die.
Not the owl. Cedric says to you.
Okay.
And he doesn't say, don't go in the desert. He says...
What does he say?
He says, whoa, watch out, Graham! There's a desert! Or something like that. Or he says something like, oh, there's nothing but a hot, dry desert that way, Graham!
Yeah.
I'll stay here!
Now, in every other part of King's Quest V, where Cedric, sorry, to disrespect your friend...
He's not my friend, he's my enemy.
Well, you respect him enough to want me to call him his name.
No, I think you need
so
to
make in it every clear. Other in every other time, like if you go into the pub where he tells you not to go, you die.
Ooh, not going there, Graham.
If you go near the snake that he tells you not to go to, you die.
Watch out, Graham! A poisonous snake!
If you fall into the river that he warns you about, you die.
But he doesn't warn you until you've already walked in the area that triggers the falling in.
Yeah.
So that's stupid.
But in any case, every other single time owl says, don't go there, you die. Except in this case, I was wandering around King's Quest V land for like an hour going, I have no idea what more I can do. Because the owl told me not to go in the desert. And every other time I listened to it, I didn't listen to him, I died. So eventually I'm like, you know what, screw the owl. I walked in the desert, and that's how you get part to the next part of the game.
Well, but he didn't... He tells you that he'll wait outside when you go into the town. And
yeah, because he tells you it's... Yeah, I mean, he tells you it's dangerous.
Yes.
And in every other case he indicates danger, you die.
Oh, okay. Well,
so my issue with that is it doesn't set a consistent set of expectations, you know, or feedback. So I didn't want to do the same mistake because that was frustrating to me. So I've altered the design of that part.
Yeah.
So further action is required, and therefore it's more logical because you've changed something. You've changed something observable, and therefore you understand that now I'm not going to fail.
Good.
Rather than going, well, if I do the exact same thing that made me fail last time, I'm not going to fail this time, which doesn't make logical sense, you know. So that's something that, like, playing another game and being frustrated with it has taught me. And I think that's a really good, like, example of why it's good to play games in the genre that you design in, and in other genres, to see what they do that you like, to see what they do that you dislike, and what you can take away from that as education, you know.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So, yeah.
That's a good thing. I'll tell you what I learned from A Golden Wake.
Tell me.
I learned many things working on A Golden Wake. I learned, as I stretch because I'm sleepy. Anyway, I learned a lot about listening to beta testers.
Yep.
And kind of get it working away from my stubbornness. And I don't know if I told this story or not, but one of the early comments that the beta testers made was that they thought that the sidewalk cycle for the main character looked funny and like jelly. And I had done the walk cycle. It was one of the first things I had done, and I had rotoscoped it, and I was very stubborn, and I was like, I'm not going to change this, you know. I've tweaked it around the speed and everything, and it works fine. And then...
Yeah.
Yeah, so I had to swallow my pride, and I redid it, and it looks 10 times better now. And, you know, it was just... It didn't really take much time at all. It was just the idea of it was... Of having to redo it just seemed like much more of a daunting task than actually doing it was.
It's easy to be stubborn as well and to be proud and go, yeah, what do they know, you know? It's a walk cycle.
Especially coming from a background where you're doing freeware games, so, you know.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be like this, but, I mean, it is. The standards of a freeware game are not the same standards as a commercial game. I mean, that's not to say that you should strive to make your freeware game crap. I mean, you know, you shouldn't be complacent. You should, you know, you should, if you're making a freeware game just for fun, you know, you should try and make it the best you can, because that way you can improve your skills, and should you choose to go commercial.
That's also part of the learning process.
Yeah, exactly.
Is to push yourself.
Exactly. But working on a commercial game where you know that you can't get away with just being lazy, or else people are going to notice a lot more than a freeware game, and people will be a lot less forgiving than in a freeware game, then, yeah, you definitely have to get out of your head and let that stubbornness go and listen to criticisms and listen to what people tell you. Mm. I also learned a lot about backgrounds, as we discussed. I mean, I was, for the better part of about a year and a half, 2 years, doing the backgrounds, and just looking at some of the early ones versus some of the later ones, I've noticed a big difference. Even just, like, looking at... I drew a background the other day, and just using the techniques that I've learned, it wasn't... I mean, I said I was trying new things, and I was, in a way, but even just, like, sticking to the stuff I learned while doing stuff for Golden Wake and just improving on those things, I was able to put out something that I was pleased with and I thought looked better than anything I did in A Golden Wake, which is frustrating too, because then you want to go back and redo everything. But that's another story.
Mm. That's really hard to get over that.
Yeah. But in any case, the point is that, you know, I learned things, and as far as background drawing, and
yeah,
I can put those into practice now. But yeah, it was overall a very interesting learning experience.
I think one thing you brought up was with the walk cycle, like swallowing your pride and going, okay, you know, five people have complained about this. There's a problem here.
Yeah, exactly.
You
know?
If 5 people out of 20 have said something about an issue in your game, there's something, and it's like, yeah. I know personally, I have a real hard time swallowing my pride and going, you know, okay, this person's got a valid point. Because I worked by myself for so long.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened to me.
Yeah. So it was really hard, and it still can be really hard for me to go, you know what, okay, this person needs this change, I'll change it, you know? And I mean, I redo stuff a fair bit because, you know, this is my job. But I believe, like, if you really want to learn, you have to be willing to listen to people and say, like, I know in the Critics Lounge a lot of the times, you know, I used to get a fair bit of guidance from there. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you'd post something and people would give you feedback and you'd think, oh, what do they know, you know?
Yeah.
And then I'd think, well, hang on, why did I post this if I didn't want feedback?
Exactly.
It's time to listen. It's time to make the change. And that's when I started really learning stuff from the Critics Lounge, is when I said, instead of going, you know, okay, I know how to draw, you know, I just wanted these people to tell me that it looks good, which is why I posted it in the Critics Lounge.
Oh, sure, yeah. I can get behind that sentiment 100%.
Yeah, but you have to say, okay, I need to learn. These people can help me, mm-hmm. you know. Even if they can't help me, like, even if they're not a higher skill level than you, they can see things that you've missed.
Right. It's always good to get fresh eyes on things. Well, case in point, the background I just mentioned, I painted it and I thought, okay, I'm happy with this. And then I showed it to you and you were like, yeah, this is nice, but there's these things that you need that you've missed. And I went back and I improved them, and I think it made it look way better. So,
yeah,
it's, you know, we still talked about it, you know, talk to me again in 3 months and see how I feel about it then.
That's what I said, because I know that there's stuff that with, you know, certain things that you'll learn over time naturally,
mm-hmm.
that you'll be able to improve coming back to a scene that you've done. You know? And I think it's very much an evolution-based thing rather than revolution, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not about waking up one day and going, oh, man, I'm going to change everything completely. It's about going, this is a gradual progression,
mm-hmm.
and it's time to, you know, focus on this. And also, like, this is what I do. Like, as you know, I've been drawing, like, pretty much I sit down and do a facial study every day. You know?
Which is very... I admire your diligence, because I don't think I can... See, my problem is, and I mentioned this yesterday to Dave, was that... Because we were talking about you. I was like, man, that Ben Chandler, he stinks. And he looks like a cat. And Dave was like, yeah, you're right, he does.
Mm.
And amongst all the insults and things, I was like, yeah, you know, I really admire the fact that Ben can sit down and do a study. Because if I sit down and I draw something, if it's not for Hugh's Day, and, you know, I just draw something, I tend to get frustrated and want to give up easily, because to me, if I draw something that's not going to be used for something, I feel like, you know, be it a background or a portrait or something, I feel like, you know, just doing it for the sake of doing it is a waste of time, because I could be using that time to draw something that I actually can use, which is a terrible attitude to have, because it negates the idea of practicing and getting better. But it's just, yeah, it's a bad habit that I have that I want to get out of. But I've never really thought that sitting down and just drawing something for the sake of improving is worth the time, as terrible as that sounds. But you have to do it.
Well, I guess I can understand, like, you want to be productive. Like, especially before, like, when I was working a lot. Like, well, I mean, I work now because this is my job. But before, when this wasn't my job, my drawing time was kind of limited. Mm-hmm. And I was like, every drawing has to count because, you know, I've got to do 40 scenes for this game. And then I've got, you know, all these animations to do. Right. So every single moment was precious. But now that I've got the opportunity, you know...
Well, even more
before,
so
I used to do practices.
Yeah, but what I don't, what also the other thing is, you know how there's that old thing we all say where it's like, you know, I make adventure games all day. The last thing I want to do is play another adventure game. If you spend all day drawing, the last thing I'm going to want to do is, you know, if I spend the whole day doing character portraits, the last thing I'm going to want to do is do a study to draw more faces, you know?
Well, in that case, like for me, I don't do faces at work much.
Right.
That's not my thing. So that's the thing that I'm going to be improving the least at, which is why it's the thing I need to practice in my spare time.
Right.
You know, so if I've been doing backgrounds all month, I'm going to focus on drawing characters, you know. If I've been drawing characters a lot or doing animations or something like that, my spare time, I'm going to practice my backgrounds. Like, as I said to you the other day, the hardest thing is when you're in a situation like you and I are, where you do multiple different sort of schools of art, multiple disciplines, you know, you're doing animations, you're doing characters, you're doing backgrounds, all that different stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is that you're instead of being able to focus on one and getting really, really good by specializing, you have to try and improve everything gradually, bit by bit. So you never really see super amazing progress. It's always really gradual as each little thing. And for me, like, it was funny because the other day when you were doing your background and I was kind of counseling you, going, come on, be patient, you know, make the most of this. It's a chance to learn. It's a chance to do this. At the same time, I'm going, you know what, I'm actually really impatient as well, you know. It's a problem I really, you know, I struggle from. And you, like the drawing I did yesterday, I did a picture of a guy with a beard, you know, and halfway through I nearly gave up. And I look at it now and I'm glad I didn't, because it came out like it came out to a degree where I'm like, well, that's an improvement over my last one. You know, which is always my goal. And but I nearly gave up because I lack confidence and I'm impatient, you know?
Sure.
And
two things I also suffer from.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people do. And I got halfway and I'm looking at it, I'm like, there's no way this is ever going to look even half reasonable, you know? Just looking at it, I'm like, I can't, there's no way. But I forced myself to stick with it because I was really interested in seeing if I could get it to look better. And after a certain point, you know,
I find this is true of many things, like be it backgrounds or portraits. This happened to me so many times, and I think it's just a thing that happens, is that it works like, you know, crests and valleys, or hopefully just one valley and two crests, where you start going in on a high, and you're just like, okay, look, I'm excited about this, I'm going to be able to do this. You start off confident, you start working on it, and halfway through or at some point through, you start losing yourself, and you're just like,
I think it's,
this is
for me,
terrible.
It's a little bit earlier than halfway for me.
Yeah, usually. it's earlier than halfway for me too. But yeah, it's, you know, you start losing your confidence, and you're just like, no, this is terrible. Every brushstroke I do looks awful. You know, I want to give up, whatever. But if you keep pressing on, then it suddenly starts to take shape, and then you go up on a high again, and you're just like, okay. And then hopefully you're happy with how it turns out. It happened to me just yesterday. I was doing a portrait. And I was trying to, it was even extra difficult because I was trying to recreate one that I had already did in a higher res, or I had already done. Listen to me, I can't talk because I'm sleepy. I was trying to recreate one that I had already done in a higher resolution. And I was happy with how the original had turned out because it had to do, you know, there was a lot of fabric and a lot of creases and things like that that are tough to get right. And, you know, I was blobbing in my darks and my lights to shade everything and get everything looking all right. And I wasn't happy with it. And I was just like, man, you know, this is never going to look as good as the original, blah, 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 et cetera, all those horrible thoughts that come into your mind. Yeah. And, you know, I just pressed on and I finished it. And I actually think it looks better than the original now. So there you go.
I think that's the same with any discipline relating to anything like in-game making or anything like that. Sometimes you'll have like a puzzle and you know that it can work and you just can't get the design to work, you know, and you just have to just stick at it and, you know, work at it from different angles. Sometimes you're trying to code something and no matter what you do, you can't get it to work. And, you know, there have been points where I've been trying to code something in AGS, I just can't get it to work and I give up.
Oh yeah, me too. You know? And then I swear a lot at you on Skype usually.
Yeah. But there's, it's like, to be able to do this properly, you have to be able to push yourself to go, it's time to stick with it. Like writing a scene, like writing an important scene in a game is like, it's hard work, you know? Like, I mean, a lot of people think that writing is just putting some words down and going like, I'm sad he's dead.
Yeah. I'm sad too.
You know, like, just this character, oh, it's an emotional bit in the story, so people are going to connect with it. That's not true at all. You have to really think about stuff. And it can be, like, I know there's scenes in games that I wrote four times over just trying to get it right. And I know Dave's done the same. I know you've done the same. Yeah. I'm sure everyone's done it, you know. And there's points where you're like, this is never going to work. This is never going to be good. You really have to just push yourself to stick with it. And not only that, it really helps to learn to ask people to look at it. Learn to ask people for feedback. I think that's, like, one of the most important things I've learned is to respect other people's input. And, you know, everyone's got the ability to help you potentially with something.
Yeah.
So.
And, I mean, there's that old saying, no matter how good you are, there's always someone who's better than you. And it's true.
There's always a bigger fish. Yeah.
There is always a bigger fish. So, you know, you can, you know, if you, the AGS community at least is good in that, you know, people are mostly friendly and approachable. So if there's
Except
someone
me.
Who, well, yeah, and me too. I bite. People, you know, who do work that you respect and you admire can, you know, you shouldn't be afraid to ask them for help and or advice or anything like that, because they can impart their wisdom on you. I mean, we're full of ourselves and we do silly voices and say stupid things, but I like to think that we, you know, our podcast has at least helped someone in some way.
Really? You
know. Well, I mean, we've kind of, amidst all the nonsense, I think we've said a few helpful things. I hope we've said a few helpful things.
Over 52 episodes, surely there's one nugget of wisdom that you can take away.
Probably, hopefully. But I'm glad that you I'm glad that you ventured into other subjects, because we tend to talk about art a lot, because, you know,
it's my job, and it's what you seem to enjoy doing the most.
Yeah,
at least focus on doing the most.
Yeah, well, it's definitely the area that I feel the least confident in, and I feel that I need to improve constantly in. But let's talk about other fields of game making and how you can improve your skills and what you've learned and practice, and those being, like, you know, coding and writing and just design in general. How would you, coding, I can't really speak too much about coding because, as I've said several times, I'm not good at it. And, I mean, I know the basics, but usually I hit a roadblock if I'm trying to do something complex, and eventually I just go and search the forums and see if anyone else has done anything similar. Unless it has to do with dynamic sprites or draw surface, in which case I'm completely clueless. But I mean, I don't know, coding just seems like something that you just learn by doing, and just, you gotta keep at
it's,
it. Like
it's
anything
like
else.
Anything right. else. Yeah. It's like, and like, I will tell you this, like, in order to learn how to code some of the stuff that I've coded that people are like, how did you code that, you know, I practice coding. I've genuinely got test games around where I just wake up like one day and just go, I'm going to practice coding this.
Sure.
I'm going to practice coding that. Once, it's about knowing your tools, knowing your engine. It's about reading the manual, and it's about seeing other people having coded similar things, seeing other people's workarounds, because once you understand a workaround for one thing, similar workarounds can be used on other things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's also about being creative.
Sure.
There'll be some limitations where you're like, I can't do that, but you can go, well, I can put, you know, I can directly write the text onto a dynamic sprite, and doing that, I can manipulate it like this onto a drawing surface, and I've gotten around the limitation of the engine like that, you know? It's stuff like that. By knowing what you can do, by having a more comprehensive understanding of the language you're going to be using, whether it be by talking to people or by experimentation or just reading the documentation, you can expand your ability to code certain things, you know?
Sure.
I started out with very limited coding abilities, and so anything interesting that I've coded has been through the fact that I experiment a lot and genuinely make myself sit down and go, I'm going to code something that's not going to be useful in the game today, because in 2 years' time, I might be able to use that.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. I know one thing that I learned from A Golden Wake, and I believe I told the story a couple of podcasts ago, was how less is more with code, or just how to trim down your code. Because one of the problems that I've noticed with coding is that it's very easy to overblow it. And, you know, it's easy to do simple things. You can easily do something with less code than necessarily it takes to... Wow, I can't talk.
Sometimes you use more code than is necessary for a function.
Exactly. Thank you. And I told the story about the cars and changing the colors and all that stuff. So yeah, it's basically that. That's where I was getting at.
It's basically, it's a sign of like a sort of immaturity in your approach to design, because you're not fully aware of what you can do. Like, the more you know your functions, the quicker you can arrive at a solution. So yeah, coding, and also like, it's like anything. If you're going to be a writer, you have to have at least some idea how words look or how words sound. If you, like, it's like you said, when people try and write Americans as saying howdy and you know, all that stuff, that you have to actually understand how a thing works to a degree. You don't, not well, I mean, it happens, but it's very rare that someone will just pick up a musical instrument and start playing and have it sound good.
Right.
You have to be able to listen to people and go, okay, that sounds good, that sounds bad.
Right, this, and you have to you have to avoid cliches, just like we talked about avoiding symbols in art and drawing noses how you think noses should draw. You should be drawn. Don't write people how you think they should sound. Like, you know, I laughed last night because in the Sherlock Holmes game, there was a, there was a French guy, and so of course I was reading him in a cheesy French accent, but then he says, oh, but of course, and I was like, well, of course he's going to say that, they're going to write him to say that, because it's, he's a French guy, and French people go, oh, but of course, you know, but they don't necessarily do that, and just like no French person ever says sacre bleu, so...
Do you know, oh, I got a funny story, I haven't told you this, my grandma... she makes cards as like a little Martha Stewart hobby thing, and she loves doing it, and actually I helped her make a card when I was down there before, so I'm pretty crafty, and she was making a card for my uncle and aunt's anniversary, and they love Paris and they've been to Paris like pretty recently, and she wanted to put some French words in there. And she has like stamps with different stuff on it, and one of the stamps that she randomly got has C'est la vie on there, and she was like, can I put this on the card? I'm like, I think saying you're still married, that's life, might give the wrong idea, like for an anniversary card. So we had a bit of a giggle about that.
I see. You know? Yeah.
So poor grandma. But I thought that would, that meant, but that's an exact, like, that's the kind of thing, if you don't understand, you're just like, well, here's a French sounding thing, and I'll just put that on.
Sure.
You know?
There is, here's the thing. Just like you mentioned, well, you gave an example, I believe, last podcast about, like, swearing, you know?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
If it's just, like, if you write, and you have to be informed when you write, or even, like, when you speak. It's just like, if you are talking to someone at a party, you know, and you're, or some social event or something, just, you're talking to somebody, and they start talking about things, and it becomes apparent that they have no idea what they're talking about. You know, that person becomes the object of ridicule. I was watching, revisiting a bit of Fry and Laurie. Have you watched a bit of Fry and Laurie?
I love a bit of Fry and Laurie.
Good. Okay, so there's a sketch in one of the early episodes in the first series, and I think it's a recurring sketch where, you know, Fry and Laurie are at a Greek restaurant. And and Hugh Laurie is, you know, he's playing this character who's very much, he's very, you know, boisterous and very full of himself and very putting on airs that he knows a lot more than he actually does. So, you know, they bring him the Greek food and the retsina, and he's like, oh, this wine's corked, it's terrible. And the guy, and, you know, Stephen Fry is very calmly explaining to him that, no, that's how it's supposed to be. That's, you know, this is retsina. It has, you know, resin in it. And he's like, So he's, you know, he's pretending that he knows all this stuff and he's very cultured and worldly, when in reality he's not, and he comes off as a buffoon. And that's the funniness of the sketch. So, you know, it's the same thing. Like, you know, you have to research what you're doing, and you have to sound like you know what you're talking about, or preferably know what you're talking about. Otherwise, you come off as silly. I mean, it's very easy, especially depending on what type of game you're doing. You know, if you're doing some sort of factual based game, and your game is full of anachronisms, which I was guilty of, and I actually just found one today, which I mean I can get away with by virtue of the fact that the character is very much a boisterous, you know, person who isn't necessarily telling the truth. But you know, if you are, you know, your entire foundation crumbles the minute that you show a crack in the wall of your, you know, of this world that you've built. So you have to stay consistent. I mean, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a factual thing. If you are building a fantasy world and you've established the rules, or, you know, a fictional world and you've established rules and you go against those, you contradict yourself, then the player's like, hang on, you know, there's nothing that takes you out of something quicker than just not playing by your own rules. It's like, I love giving this example, the movie Face Off, which you have not seen, but I've told you this story.
You have told me about it, yeah.
So in this movie, we're led to believe as the viewer that not only are facial transplants possible, but they also have chips that they implant in people's voice boxes to make them sound like the other person. Okay, that's fine.
That's ridiculous.
But that's fine. If that's what we have to believe to make this movie work, that's fine. And, you know, I can suspend disbelief and, you know, believe that people fall for the fact that these people had this facial surgery, never mind that their body types are completely different. Whatever. But what gets me about that movie is that when they're installing the chip into Nicolas Cage's character, they say to him, be very careful, this is a very delicate chip, even a violent cough could dislodge it, and then your cover will be blown. And he spends the whole movie getting the shit kicked out of him, and like falling off of things, and whatever, and the thing doesn't dislodge until the very end, when it becomes convenient to the plot, and he needs to prove...
Cough.
Yeah, he does something really simple. Like, I don't remember if he coughs or if he just, like, falls over or something. But it then dislodges, and that's how he can prove that he's actually who he is. And, see, that just ruined it for me. I mean, the movie itself was dumb. But that itself, you know, it didn't play by its own rules, and that just annoyed me.
So, basically, in order to improve as a writer, one thing you can do is to examine other people's work, other writers' work, and see what works, what doesn't. And sort of, it's the same with art, you know, look at things, see what works, see what doesn't.
Yeah, exactly.
A skilled writer will also, you know how to lead a player, you know, and how to subtly suggest things. Like, yeah, I love certain writers, you know, and I love certain aspects of their work. And so when I write anything, I think, what do they do that I want to do? So having an example in all things, whether it's coding, writing, art, animation, whatever, having an example to follow can be very helpful. It can be a sort of guidepost.
This
is what to do, this is what not to do.
Just like reference photos when you paint. Works when you write, or when you code, I guess, too.
Oh, well, yeah, sure. Oh, well, a lot of the times, like, for code, I'll have, like, reference code left over where I can go, how did I do that back then? Because it's a lot quicker.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, so having a very, like, immerse yourself in a wide range of works, both good and bad, gives you a good idea across the board of sort of, you know, skills, gives you a good idea of what works, what doesn't, and, you know, and helps you go, well, how can I be more like that writer? How can I be more like that artist? What have they done that I don't know how to do yet?
Exactly.
I think it's really hard with writing, especially because it's this really kind of, it's not as tangible as music or as art or as code, where you've got, like, you see a piece of art and it's often easy to go, okay, that looks really, you know, when something looks phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, with coding, you know, if something's working really effectively because it's tangible, you get the feedback from the program when you run it.
Mm-hmm.
With music, you can hear it in your ears. So with writing, it's a little less easy to go, that's a moving scene, or that's built some suspense in. It's a little harder, you know. You have to rely a little bit on player feedback.
Yeah, I'd say writing is a little bit more akin to art, because, you know, as the artist, especially if you're like us, who, you know, we draw something, or we, you know, and people might say, oh, that looks amazing, that looks great, but, you know, you as the person who knows it and you know all the tricks or the flaws that it has, you're like, it's crap.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing with writing. You know, you can write something and be like, whatever. And people can be like, oh, wow, this is really well written. That's what happens to me all the time. Like I said last time, you know, people tell me, oh, this is really well written. I'm just like, well, I just, you know, thank you, but I don't know what I did that's so special, you know. I just wrote what I thought people sound like. So, yeah.
Yeah. But also, like, you've exposed yourself to enough films and games and stuff that you go, well, this is going to be ridiculous if I write it like that.
It's
going to break the immersion.
I've also exposed myself to enough people that, you know, they...
Yeah, well, that's it, you know, it's...
No, I... Yeah. And so then they're like, oh my god, put your pants back on. And I'm like,
I see.
That's
I thought you meant actually talking to people. I find this is really interesting for me. A lot of times I'll hear something and that kind of, like, someone will tell me a story. I love listening to people.
Yeah, sure.
Like, I'm a very talkative guy, but I love especially old people. I love, like, just letting an old person talk and listening to what they say. Because it comes from the heart, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And they're great. They're not always good storytellers, but a lot of the times they're telling stuff that they lived through, and you can't get any more immersive than something you've lived through.
Yeah.
So it's really, for me, I love... like just letting an old person talk, or even a young person, you know, let them tell you a story and see how that story affects you, and see what it is about that story that affects you. Like,
sure.
I've been doing that a lot lately.
So I have a little anecdote from a film that I watched this week, which I think suits this. And then I would like you, because you referenced it last podcast. I think you should lead by example and tell the story that your grandmother told you that you laughed about that was quite funny to end the podcast on, because I'm getting very sleepy. But I watched a movie called The Trip this week, which is actually it was a TV series which was edited into a film. It stars Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, who are two amusing English comedians. And basically the premise of this film is that Steve Coogan is going on a trip around Northern England to stay at several different little hotels and, you know, taste the food and write a review on them. And his girlfriend decides at the last minute that she doesn't want to come, and so he enlists Rob Brydon, and they go, and they basically just spend the whole time driving around and having conversations and, you know, musing about life and whatnot, all sorts of different things. And there's one scene which I, in particular, it stood out to me, because, I mean, it's not that the film is boring, it's just, it's a little slow, and, you know, it's all about the conversations, and, you know, I can see how it would be a polarizing film. You'll either really enjoy it if you like, you know, Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, which I do, or you'll find it boring, because essentially that's it, they drive around and they talk. But one scene in particular stood out to me, because it just seemed so very real, and it's a scene in which they're in a part of England where there's some sort of geological formation that was caused by the volcanic rock or something. And Steve Coogan, he's not, you know, he's kind of feeling depressed because, you know, he's playing an exaggerated version of himself where he's depressed and he's just like, am I good enough? I should be better in my career than this, whatever. So he kind of...
Is he an artist?
He's an actor. He's a comedian.
I was joking.
Yeah, I know. He might as well be. Well, yeah. He is an artist. These actors are artists.
Yes.
Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So he's having sort of an existential crisis, and he kind of goes up to... He goes up to the thing to look at it, and he's all by himself, and he's kind of, you know, having some alone time and watching the sunrise and the majesty. And this old man with a backpack comes around, and he's just there. And, you know, the old man greets him, and he's just like, oh, hi, how are you, you know. And then the old guy starts talking, and he's just, like, rambling on and on about the geological formation. He's just like, yeah, you know, it's really interesting how this and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he's giving him, like, a whole history lesson. And you can tell that he just, Steve has no interest in it. And he's just kind of appeasing the guy just by, like, oh, yeah, yeah, that's very interesting. Oh, yeah, mm-hmm, uh-huh. And you can see in his face that he's just desperate to run away, but he's too polite to just be like, yeah. And, you know, that's a real thing that happens. I've had experiences like that, you know, where the person doesn't know that they're just rambling and you want them to shut up. And you just, you know. So then finally, he just kind of like starts walking further, taking steps further away from him. And the guy's like following him. And then eventually he's just like, he walks away and he's like, okay, bye now. Best be on my way. Bye. And the guy's just like, oh, okay, bye. And it was poignant. It was funny, but it was also kind of sad, because it's like, you know, the old guy's lonely. He wants someone to talk to. He wants all this stuff to say. And, you know, there were just so many things in that scene that just struck a chord that it was probably my favorite scene of the movie, even though it was very delightfully awkward.
Okay. Well, life is delightfully awkward, and people are delightfully awkward.
Exactly. Mm. I mean, listen to this podcast for a prime example of that.
Well,
anyway.
I haven't even giggled yet.
That's true. Please tell the story about your grandmother told.
Okay, this actually isn't that funny, but when she told it, the way she told it, we both cracked up laughing on the spot. My grandma She went to school. They actually moved around a fair bit because her father had a few different jobs, and then he went off to the war. Which really, he went off to the war for several years, and they didn't see him for that time, which is a long time. Like in my in my limited appreciation of, because you know we live in a modern world, and it seems so weird to me, so alien. Yeah. But anyway, so they're at a place fairly near from where she is now. Like, I say fairly near, but I'm, like, you know, 50 kilometres away. But in Australia, that's really close. That's, like, next door. So her and her friend, Betty Gunn, who actually, I know the old house they used to live in. They were walking home from school. They used to walk home from school together, and it was several miles. And they decided one day that they would try yodeling. So her and Betty and her sister was sort of tagging along, but she was kind of the younger sister and had nothing to do with it. So they tried yodeling, which is hilarious to me because yodeling, it's not even singing. It's like, it's just the ravings of a lunatic who just decides, like, I think it's amazing. Like, yodeling by itself is funny to me. If I hear someone yodeling, I'm just like, that's hilarious. You know, yodeling Bill.
Yeah, sure.
Right, so they decide to yodel, which is like the best decision you can make in your life at that point.
This was to pass the time while walking home from school?
I guess it was to entertain themselves, you know?
Fair
enough. So they're walking home from yodeling, and after a bit of yodeling, you know, I guess they practice over several days. I don't know if they had particular songs that they yodeled. I don't know the hits of the time. Maybe like the top 40 was like, there were 10 or 15 yodeling hits that they were like, let's throw these into the mix.
Well, this was World War One, right? Or World War Two?
No, World War Two.
Oh, okay, so
how old do you think my grandmother is? My goodness.
Well, my anyway. She's about as old as my grandmother. Well, yeah, that's true. My grandmother was born in 1935, so...
Yeah. Right, so anyway... So they've done this, they've learned this yodel. Well, I say learned, they've self-taught themselves to yodel.
Sure.
And the decision is made that a concert should be put on for the family, and at a strictly a cappella yodeling concert.
Sure, okay.
Which by itself to me is an amazing concept, because who doesn't want to see that? Who doesn't want to see two schoolgirls yodeling for the family? Like, that's your, because this is like, there's sure, no it's, television.
It's
there's
the
no,
40s, it's the early 40s,
yeah,
I'm presuming.
You know, and there's none of this stuff. There's no, you don't just plug in your iPod and get the latest yodeling hit.
Of course not. You're lucky if you get radio reception out there in the outback.
Yeah, so they decide to put on a yodeling concert for the family, but in their shame, because they knew, I mean, I think you know, if you're yodeling, you know, and I'm sorry to anybody that comes from, like, Yodelville or wherever yodeling comes from, I apologize if I'm offending your sensibilities, but yodeling is silly.
I think it comes from Switzerland, from the Swiss Alps.
Probably. Okay, so from any Switzerland people listening... It's not real singing. It's hardly even music. It's just funny noises that are amazing. I love it, but don't pretend to me that it's not embarrassing to do.
The Swiss don't get angry. They're very neutral about these sorts of things.
Good. So, anyway. Instead of being ashamed because they know,
yes.
They decide, instead of standing there and just performing, what they're going to do is they're going to arrange the family so that they're sitting looking at a tree and they're going to stand behind the tree and perform the yodeling concert. And apparently, this all goes off without a hitch. The concert's done. They hide behind the tree.
Sure, it's a yodeling tree.
They yodel behind the tree, and then they come out probably flush with embarrassment to their proud parents who went...
Who applaud.
Who probably just went, well. Because what else do you say when someone's just done a yodeling concert for you behind a tree?
Well, anyway. I mean, you know, you encourage them and you applaud, and you say, good job, girls. That's very good that you've done this.
The next morning, when her mother went out to collect the eggs,
yes.
The rooster that used to roost in the tree every night was dead on the ground. That's the end of the story. That's it. That's all there is. There's no amazing end. That's it. So her mother, for the rest of like her life, like, basically mocked her for killing a rooster, which basically, I believe, goes to say, if you're going to yodel, yodel responsibly.
Yeah.
Yodel in a safe place and yodel under supervision, please.
Well, either that or they made an important discovery, which is, you know how there's that email that's been circulating the internet for years that is full of all sorts of stupid random facts that are probably not true, like, you know, a duck's quack doesn't echo and cat urine glows under a black light or whatever. Maybe yodeling kills roosters.
Let's start a chain email.
Yeah.
Let's put it on BuzzFeed.
Yeah, okay. Or Reddit or something.
10 things you won't believe about yodeling.
Yeah. What the other thing is that people actually do it.
That it was popular once.
Yeah. Well, ironic thing there is that roosters crowing kind of sounds like yodeling in a way.
A little bit. Not really.
It'd be lonely.
It's a very primal yodel.
Yeah, I guess.
Very primal avian yodel.
Yeah. So good. either there's a great coincidence in that there was just the rooster's time, or the yodeling killed it. I prefer to think that the yodeling killed the rooster.
I want to think that the yodeling drove him to kill himself, because I have a dark sense of humor.
He committed rooster suicide because he was like, dear God, they're yodeling on my... Well, if he was...
Maybe, like, after the concert, it was like, you know what? I don't think I could handle seeing that again. I don't think I could handle that again. I've made this decision. I'm taking my feathery life into my own hands. It ends tonight.
Well, roosters don't have
hands. I never asked for this.
Roosters don't have hands, though.
No.
It's my own wings, then.
That's true.
But here's the thing, though. If the rooster was in the tree, and they were yodeling while he was in the tree, couldn't he have just, like, you know, shit on them or something to shut them up?
Well, maybe he didn't need to go. Maybe his cloaca was vacant. That's a possibility. And he's not going to be able to lay an egg on them, because he's a rooster.
Yeah.
So he's a poor defenseless bird.
Well, oh well.
Against the yodeling enthusiasm of schoolgirls. It's a terrifying mental image.
It really is. It really is. And on that note, I think we should end this podcast, because as soon as we start talking about cloacas, that's when you know we've jumped the shark, so to speak.
So, nicely agree.
Yes, smiley. So, thanks for listening to the Blue Cup Tools podcast. This has been episode 52. We hope you learned something, as we did. And if you are so inclined to follow us on Twitter, you may follow our podcast at @BCT_podcast. You may follow young Mr. Chandler at
Ben_304.
Yes, and you may follow myself at, well, you may follow me. You may follow me at Grundislav Games. That's GRUNDISLAV
Grundislav.
Grundislav Games. Man, many people are going to be disappointed that that's not in a golden wig, but you know what?
I know, actually.
I know at least one person. I know, Ray's is very furious. I'm sorry, Ray's. I wanted to have it in there, but it just didn't fit thematically.
Mm.
It'll be in the next game, I promise. Anyway, also, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, even though iTunes is no good, and we had a little falling out because
said no to iTunes this week. Oh man, did I tell you that David Lynch's son called me the C word on Twitter?
You did, yes, and you were very proud of it.
I wasn't proud of myself because what I he said was mean about him.
He but called
I
was, you a cloaca? Like,
a what, sorry? Yeah, he did. I did the wrong thing, and yet somehow I can't quite regret it. I'm a bad person, and yet I'm happy that it led to that.
Well, you know, if a famous director's son insults you on Twitter, I think that's pretty much... Excuse me. I think that's pretty much the best thing you can have happen to you.
It's the highlight of my week.
Good. Yeah, good. The highlight of my week was